101, The Hits.
Hello, I'm Esther Githu Ewart. Welcome to Africa 54. Here's what's coming up.
The U.S. military pullout from Niger has a major impact on efforts to fight terrorism in the region. A new homegrown school feeding program initiative is reshaping the lives of smallholder farmers and students in Malawi. And African stories, both oral and written, serve as an educational tool to impart ethical values to young people. All this and much more coming up on today's Africa 54.
We begin our broadcast at the crossroads of North and Central Africa in Chad, where French and Chadian officials met to sign documents as France officially handed over its first military base as part of the withdrawal of its military forces from the Sahel country. Chad's military chief of staff says the base of Faya Lagu in the north has been handed over. The transition took place in accordance with the conditions agreed with Chad, according to the French military chief of staff. Chad last month abruptly ended military cooperation with its former colonial power, and French troops began leaving the country last Friday. Chad had been a key link in France's military presence in Africa and its last foothold in the wider Sahel region after the forced withdrawal of French troops from Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger in the wake of a series of military coups. The U.S. military completed its withdrawal from Niger in September, where it had two bases that helped partners in the Sahel counter terrorism. The pullout came after members of Niger's military staged a coup in 2023. The U.S. military says the withdrawal has had a major impact on efforts to fight terrorism in the region. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Burb has more.
With the U.S. military now out of Niger, defense officials say their presence in West Africa has dropped from about 1,000 troops at this time last year to fewer than 300 today.
Our goal.
U.S. Major General Kenneth Ekman led the withdrawal of U.S. forces who were helping counter violent extremist organizations, or VEOs, in the Sahel.
If there was one country that was most important on our ability to address Sahelian VEO problems or the Sahelian VEO challenge, it was Niger. It is a strategic setback with regards to how each of us pursues our security objectives in the region.
Military analyst Bill Raggio says the already dire terrorism in West Africa is worsening.
The jihadists have been on the march. In some countries, it's stunning. For instance, Burkina Faso. It's admitted that about 40% of the country is under control of al-Qaeda's branch there.
He says that without a major base to host troops and surveillance drones, U.S. and French counter-terror missions in West Africa are in bad shape.
The region has become more opaque. Absolutely.
Without the Western support that existed before the junta ousted the democratically elected government, Niger has failed to hold back a rising terrorist tide. The Nigerian military says terror attacks earlier in December killed at least 39 people, including children, near the border with Burkina Faso.
In Niger, violent extremist attacks have become more lethal. That's a fact since the coup on 26 July 2023. They've got fewer resources and fewer partners.
But officials say the withdrawal doesn't mean the U.S. military is giving up on West Africa. Instead, it's resetting its efforts.
This is the nascent stages of our reset.
General Michael Langley, the head of U.S. Africa Command, told VOA in October he aims to build a new footprint to help fight the region's growing terror threat.
We pulled out of Niger. But we are engaging with coastal West Africa countries because if we look at the what direction is metastasized on the northern regions of Cote d'Ivoire, of Ghana, and Togo, and Benin.
Ekman says that requires a different approach.
If our presence in Niger allowed us to go inside out relative to the Sahelian-based VEO threat, we now have to revert to going outside in. Countries like Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Benin, Chad, our access to them and the degree to which they want to partner with us will influence how we go outside in.
And General Langley says negotiations to work with those governments will take time.
We're still in stages of defining what that host government at their higher levels of what they do want from us to be able to complete that solution set to effectively account terrorism.
As deliberations continue, more and more terrorists are threatening the very governments whom analysts say have pushed away the countries that might be able to help them. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
The United Nations estimates that the world produces over 430 million metric tons of plastic waste each year, with the largest source being single-use packaging. VOA's Valdia Baraputri has the details.
Trey's supermarket in Vienna, Virginia, near Washington, has everything a shopper needs except containers. That's right, no bags, no boxes, no bottles. If you want to bring something home, even liquids like cooking oil or shampoo, you need to come prepared. Visitors bring their own containers and weigh them, fill up what they need, and then buy their goods by weight.
I got the idea to open the store, it was like 2018, so how many years, almost 6 years ago. I got tired of seeing so much garbage and plastic and trash, like single-use coffee cups, like single-use packaging, and I knew that less and less was going to be recycled.
Persaud opened Trace in 2021. She says, according to Greenpeace data, only 6% of plastic waste in the U.S. is recycled, and she hopes stores like hers can make a difference.
In the 3 years that we've been open, we've refilled 21,000 containers. That's just containers. That doesn't even count the things that are not wrapped in plastic. That's reducing the demand for that plastic bottle.
Shopping at a refill store might not be as easy as a full-service store at first, but customer says it gives them a sense of accomplishment.
Oh, you feel good because, you know, you're doing your little bit for the environment, and the staff are very friendly and helpful, and they're very much into doing for the planet and the environment as well. So, yeah, it feels good.
In Tacoma Park in Maryland, another refill and zero-waste store called Fulfillery even offers their own self-made products. One of them is an all-purpose cleaning tablet made from recycled cooking oil.
So you open this up, and it looks, once you open it up, you cut it up, add water, and it becomes a really great cleaner. It cleans granite, it cleans wood.
Saha opened the store 4 years ago. She says changing consumer behavior, no matter how small, is key to reducing waste.
If the only thing they could do is carry around a reusable straw, that's still saving almost 500 straws a year, right? We just hope that people try to stop where they can.
According to the advocacy organization, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, there are about 1,300 stores in the U.S. with a zero-waste concept, and this number is growing. Around half are refill stores, and others are stores that have a large selection of refillable items. Valdia Baraputri, VOA News, Washington.
A new initiative is reshaping the lives of smallholder farmers and students in Malawi. The homegrown school feeding program, championed by the UN World Food Program, is bridging the gap between agriculture and public primary schools. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Pirirani Nkwate is a small-scale farmer in the Zomba district of southern Malawi. She says that about 5 years ago, she started making more money selling her crops directly to her local primary school than she did selling to middlemen.
This program has helped earn money to pay school fees for my two children. I've also bought two cows, something I never imagined before. Now I have a steady income.
Nkwate is part of the UN World Food Program's homegrown school feeding program. Since its pilot effort in 2012, the program has grown to support over 800,000 students and 35,000 farmers in 11 districts across the country.
It provides farmers with reliable markets for up to 200 school days annually, boosting incomes and resilience. And it promotes dietary diversity, offering school children meals with ingredients from Malawi's six food groups.
Donors supporting the initiative include Norway, the European Union, France, and Iceland. Students say the initiative is better than the previous feeding program, which had one fixed meal.
In the past, we were eating porridge made from soy flour only. But now, with the coming of this homegrown initiative, we are eating porridge from maize flour, potatoes cooked with ground nut flour, rice and pumpkins, and sometimes potatoes mixed with vegetables.
The World Food Program says the initiative has helped increase daily school attendance from 77% to 92% and reduce health-related absenteeism by 11%. However, some schools like Nyachenda Primary School in Insanja District, the challenge is delays in supplies.
We use the smallholder farmers that lack a lot of resources, and because of that, the food comes to our school maybe with 2 or 3 days late.
World Food Program says it is addressing the challenge, sourcing food from farmers in cooperatives around the schools. The farmers say the initiative has helped them earn enough money to construct houses, while for students, it promises a healthier and a brighter future. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Tragedy has struck again as a boat filled with migrants were just learning that at least 69 people died after a boat headed from West Africa to the Canary Islands capsized off Morocco on December 19th, according to Malian authorities. The authorities there say the makeshift boat was carrying around 80 people when it flipped over and only 11 survived. A crisis unit has been set up to monitor the situation. The Atlantic migration route from the coast of West Africa to Spain's Canary Islands, typically used by African migrants trying to reach mainland Spain, has seen a surge this year with over 41,000 arrivals in January through November. This exceeds last year's record of nearly 40,000 arrivals. Following the disputed October 9th presidential election results in Mozambique, more than 2,000 Mozambican families have sought refuge in neighboring Malawi this week, while dozens of people were reported killed in the spreading unrest in the southern African country. Up to 6,000 inmates reportedly escaped from a high-security prison in Maputo on Christmas Day after a rebellion the country police chief says was part of a widespread post-election riot and violence in the country. The escape from the Maputo Central Prison started around midday Wednesday. Some of the prisoners at the facility are reported to have seized weapons from the guards and started freeing other inmates. In the skies over the eastern U.S., countless drones have been recently spotted, and everyone from residents to the president-elect has questions. Anita Powell explains.
Airlines don't just hang out, and those aren't helicopters.
Why have a large number of drones suddenly appeared in the skies over New Jersey? Who sent them, and why? These are questions spreading across America and the world. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said Sunday there was no indication of foreign involvement. He said that authorities are on it, but pointed to stretched-thin resources.
I want to assure the American public that we are on it. We are working in close coordination with state and local authorities. And it is critical, as we all have said for a number of years, that we need from Congress additional authorities to address the drone situation. Our authorities currently are limited and they are set to expire. We need them extended.
Residents say their normally quiet skies have lit up in recent weeks as officials seek answers.
So not the size of a commercial airliner, but they're the size of a vehicle. Because if they get lower, they would get substantially bigger. And I can see that. I can tell. It's not a hobbyist. And there's so many around New Jersey throughout the whole state. Everybody's seen this for 3-4 weeks now that imagine how much money this must cost.
Top elected leaders are demanding action.
Why do we have more questions than answers? Well, we're here today for three reasons. First, to push a new but unclassified tech into wide use, the so-called Robin, to get answers on these drones, and also to announce that I am going to help pass, and I'm going to co-sponsor legislation that will combat these drones in a better way by allowing local police departments and state police departments to help the feds in citing these drones, which so many have requested.
And President-elect Donald Trump offered his own theory Monday. He would not say whether he had received a classified briefing on the matter.
The government knows what is happening. They know where it came from and where it went. And for some reason, they don't want to comment. And I think they'd be better off saying what it is. Our military knows and our president knows. And for some reason, they want to keep people in suspense. I can't imagine it's the enemy, because if it was the enemy, they'd blast it out. Even if they were late, they'd blast it. Something strange is going on.
Whatever this is, everyone agrees. They want answers. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Let us know what you think about Africa 54 and all our VOA Africa programs on our website at voaafrica.com. Still to come, a father and a daughter work toward publishing and distributing a children's book relating to African children in the diaspora. We'll be right back.
Another year is ending, and like many other years, we are about to bid farewell to the year 2024. It was a year of remarkable achievements and significant challenges. On this episode of Our Voices, we will be reviewing major events of 2024 that had profound impacts on women and girls on the continent. We will also highlight the remarkable efforts by women over the past year as they continue to demand change and progress despite the hardships they face. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in...
In other news, terrorist group Al-Shabaab says one of its top commanders, Mohamed Mire, was killed in a drone strike near Kunyo Baru in Somalia's Lower Shabelle region. Al-Shabaab did not say when the strike took place, but it is blaming the United States for the killing. The U.S. military command in Africa, in a statement late on Thursday, confirmed conducting a December 24th airstrike against Al-Shabaab. President Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea and President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud of Somalia held extensive discussions this week at the State House in Asmara, Eritrea. The two leaders focused on the consolidation of bilateral ties while also addressing regional and international issues of mutual concern. And in Sierra Leone, some of the 28,000 amputees left from the country's civil war are now training to farm and strengthen their independence. Despite its success with 100 trainees so far, the project remains a rare example. The country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission says there is currently no specific support for amputees from the government. In an attempt to end polarization in Zimbabwe's media, an organization is hosting sports events for journalists from the privately owned and state-run media. Columbus Mavunga has more.
These journalists usually compete against each other for breaking news, but today they face off on the soccer pitch in Harare. It is all part of a new initiative to end a polarized media environment. The Sports Day is set up by the non-profit Gender and Media Connect. Its national director, Patience Zirima, says she hopes sporting events like this one will reduce media polarization in Zimbabwe and improve the wellness of reporters.
This day is going to be very critical because we've seen media houses from across the divide coming together to organize this event. And I think this is just a way that the media can now be able to really come together, to network, and to be able to find common ground as they do their work.
One of those involved is Leopold Munende, a senior reporter for the media outlet New Zimbabwe and the president of the Young Journalists Association of Zimbabwe. Munende says he sees the same news events being reported on in totally different ways. But he says coming together in a relaxed manner could help change that.
We get to meet as journalists from different sides of the of the media industry, the publicly owned and the privately owned. We get to discuss the articles which we are writing, which are causing a lot of discussion.
Godfrey Maregere from the state-owned Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, which is seen as supportive of the ruling ZANU-PF party, also thinks the games are a good idea.
Tinobatsira kuti tinogona kushandidzana pamwe chete pasina kuti ZBC pasina kuti PK pasina kuti
sema journalists
se one team. Tinobatsira kuti even kwato senza nyizonga tinoita ichidzikira ende hakuna kudzikisana kuti mudzima yake kuti muri tinokwanisa kutamba zvekuita zvinhu chimwe chete. Tinokwanisa kutamba gora, tinokwanisa kutamba soccer sese yemadzimai, tinokwanisa kutamba netball yemadzimai, tinokwanisa kutamba soccer yevarume sevanhu vamwe chete.
Another benefit, say organizers, is that the sports will improve the health of those taking part and help them ease stress. The government-appointed Zimbabwe Media Commission has been calling for an end to media polarization for the benefit of audiences. Godwin Piri, its executive secretary, says there are ways media can improve the situation.
Refuse to be spokesperson for politicians. Speak for the profession. When you find yourself parroting a political position ahead of your journalistic principles, then you already have a problem.
Piri says that when reporting is polarized, the more likely it is that audiences and advertisers could be driven away, causing media outlets to close. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
African stories, both oral and written, serve as an educational tool to impart ethical values to young people while teaching them about the community and its cultural norms. Oluyemi Falomo, a retired engineer and storyteller, together with his daughter Mo Falomo, are on a mission to publish and distribute a children's book, The Princess and the Gourd. They say that for the African children in the diaspora, African stories foster a strong sense of identity and pride in their cultural heritage. VOA's Jackson Vunganyi has their story.
Storytelling, a central component of Africa's oral tradition, is a means of transmitting history, values, and wisdom from one generation to the next. But beyond entertainment, the Falomos say that it is a way for African children born in the diaspora to learn and connect with the values and culture of their ancestral home.
Making it important for us to know that it's important to work hard. And when you work hard, there are rewards for hard work. Making sure that we understand the value of, like, respecting elders within our culture. Mm. Making sure that we even speak our language, right? Those are the things that, and education as a whole, those are the values that my father instilled within me. And he used some storytelling, some emulation within just looking at his life and just how he lived his life to actually tell us.
And those are some of the lessons you're going to pass on his grandkids. Yeah.
Mo Falomo believes that African stories play a powerful role in helping children in the diaspora connect with their roots. These stories, he says, nurture a strong sense of identity and pride in their rich cultural heritage, giving them a deeper understanding of who they are and where they come from.
I wanted to ask you, Mr. Oluyemi, growing up in Nigeria, who was the storyteller in your family?
My family, storytelling came mostly from grandparents, when you go spend time with them. And because we have large families, that is, relatives live with them, so we gather outdoors.
Mm. At what time, in the evenings?
In the evening, under the moonlight. And there are riddles followed by storytelling.
Is that usually after dinner or before dinner?
After dinner.
Okay. Just a way to relax before bedtime.
Good, yeah. Night, it's not raining, the moon is... So the riddles test your ability to reason things out quickly and get a solution. And then the stories, most of the time, the stories were about... inanimate. The turtle, they hear, comparing speed
and strength.
And strength,
yeah.
Or slow, but thoughtful.
Yes, the turtles, those fables.
fables are mostly what we heard.
Let's talk about publishing. You cited this interesting statistic, the Cooperative Children's Book Center, again, saying only 12% of U.S. children's books had a black main character.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, I guess...
Best-selling books.
Mm-hmm. It opens you to this new world of publishing.
Yes.
What does it take to... What goes into publishing? What kind of resources do you need to publish a book?
Well, you know... One, I would say that to tell a story is one thing. To tell it well is very important, right? The medium with which you tell the story, the quality of the book in itself, the illustrations, the colors. So from the beginning, it was finding an illustrator that was, one, African, specific to us. She was actually Yoruba, so she understood some of the cultural nuances. The second part is working and reiterating this book multiple times to get the version that spoke to the level
that
of
captures
quality,
the essence of the story. What has that meant for you working with him closely on this project?
Sorry. I love this guy, so it's actually meant a lot to me.
That's you're getting a little emotional about it.
Sorry. My dad's done a lot for me growing up, and just his consistent show of love and care. So to be able to give of my time, to be able to give back to him, is I'm grateful to God that he's alive for me to be able to do that for him, right? I feel like this book is part of his legacy, and just the ability to walk alongside him in bringing his vision to life is a blessing within itself. So it's been a journey. My dad's a good listener. So because we're feeding off of each other and changing elements of the book, because I was like the primary editor, right? And so with editing this book and getting it to where it is, he's kind of listened. He didn't go, oh, you're changing my story, or this is not, you know. So
it's been a collaborative process.
It's definitely been a collaborative process.
That was Oluyemi Falomo, a retired engineer and storyteller, and his daughter Mo Falomo speaking with VOA's Jackson Bungani. And that's our show for today. Be sure to watch Africa 54 on our website at voaafrica.com. From all of us here in Washington, have a great and safe last weekend of the year.